Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Hello, and welcome to this latest in the OIES podcast series. My name's James Henderson, and I'm Director of the Gas Programme at OIES. Today, I'm joined by Simon Pirani, a Senior Research Fellow, to discuss his latest paper, which is called The Market Takes Shape, the Ukrainian Gas Sector to 2030. Simon, welcome to the podcast.
Good morning, Jim.
I was very interested to read in the introduction to your paper, which I should say was published about a week or so ago, that, you know, how far Ukraine has come really over the past decade. Before we get into the future, do you want to give us a little bit of context about, you know, where we are today?
Sure. The first thing that's notable is that over the last decade, demand for gas in Ukraine has halved. Some of the reasons for this are not great. That is economic downturn, the military conflict, other trials and troubles that Ukraine has gone through. Some of it is better news. It indicates greater efficiency, the market starting to work. But certainly that's a huge change, because before Ukraine was consuming about as much gas as Germany. Now it's about half of what it was previously. The second thing that's changed is in 2009, we had the new transit contract, which was signed between Ukraine and Russia. And many listeners will remember the endless series of disputes about that transit contract. The transit contract was signed together with an import contract. This relationship was always frustrating and difficult. The prices, it turned out, that were being charged for direct Russian imports to Ukraine were far above the European market, and that reflected the gap between oil-linked prices, which is what was in the Ukraine contract, and the changing European market prices. And that added to huge political tensions between Russia and Ukraine. Those came to a peak in 2014 with the removal of the government of Viktor Yanukovych by the events of that time. And since then, Ukraine has stopped buying directly imported Russian gas entirely and gets all its imported gas through so-called reverse flow from the European market. And that's also brought with it European prices. So Ukrainian domestic market prices are now very close to European prices. So it's a completely different market, a completely different gas sector from what it was 10 years ago.
And of course, the other thing that's happened is that the transit contract for Russian gas across Ukraine to Europe has also come to an end, and we've had a renegotiation there. Is the future? What's the future of transit, do you think, through Ukraine?
So the deal, which was reached at the end of last year, and many of us feared that a deal would not be reached in time, and it was quite a diplomatic achievement that it was reached, because that had government involvement from Europe, Ukraine, and Russia. That deal provides for the transit to continue to 2024. Basically, Gazprom has paid a lump sum of about just over $7 billion to cover its transit requirements through Ukraine in that time period. That was 65 BCM of transit for this year, going down to then 40 BCM a year for the succeeding years. I think that covers Gazprom's needs for Ukrainian transit quite comfortably. I think, although there's still a huge political row going on about Nord Stream 2, I think Nord Stream 2 will eventually be built, used. We've got the extensions to the Turkish Stream 2 now being completed through the Balkans in Serbia and Bulgaria. These will be used. That will mean that almost all, if not all, of Russian gas for Europe can go via alternative non-Ukrainian routes. Ukraine will become the route of last resort. So theoretically, from 2024, transit through Ukraine could be zero. Now, obviously, from Gazprom's point of view, it makes much more sense to keep that route open as and when it's needed. But I think it will be a route of last resort. And I think the transit income, which, of course, was in the past very important for Ukraine, has declined in importance. They know it's $7 billion over this period to 2024. And they know that that's the last big payment of that order that they'll receive. And after 2024, the transit business will be a minor part of the pick.
Okay, so that's in decline, but things elsewhere seem to be, you know, going in a very positive direction. I mean, so, you know, we've heard a lot about Ukraine integrating into the European gas market. You've talked about prices converging, regulation as well, and I've obviously there's flows. So I guess talk a little bit more about that integration and how it's developing.
So the regulatory convergence had started actually well before 2014. And when the Yanukovych government was still there, we had the gas market law of that time. Ukraine joined the energy community. So that's been going on for a while. The end of direct Russian imports in 2015 was another turning point, because that then meant that all imports were priced in line with the European market. So that was the pricing convergence. What we've seen in the last year or so is, first of all, the introduction of virtual reverse flow and much better flexibility in terms of the interconnections with Ukraine's Western neighbours. And secondly, something which I think was unexpected in its success, and probably related to the particular conditions created by the coronavirus pandemic, and that is the very large-scale use of Ukrainian storage capacity by traders based in Europe. And that's been a real change for the Ukrainian gas business this year. So gas has been brought across either physically, either via physical reverse flow or via virtual reverse flow. It's been stored in Ukrainian storage, very often in this so-called customs warehouse arrangement, which is basically a duty-free, and that's helped this process of integration.
Great. Well, let's delve into both those topics in a little bit more detail. In terms of the virtual reverse flow, I think there have been some obstacles to that, haven't there? I mean, you know, in terms of the interconnections with some of the Western neighbours, and there's been some issues around, I think, with Slovakia in particular. Can you talk a little bit more about that and you know, whether they've all been resolved now?
Sure. So let's talk about success. Success has been seen with Hungary, where there's virtual reverse flow, of about 80 MMCM a day. There's been success with Poland. There has indeed been a problem with Slovakia, and we had a little adventure during the summer when there was a repair done at the physical reverse flow point of Budince. The repair was undertaken by the new gas TSO of Ukraine. It took longer than EU Stream had expected, and the gas TSO of Ukraine's response to that was, well, don't worry, we can always virtually reverse the gas you want to bring into Ukraine via the much larger interconnection point at Velka Kapushani, where all the flow from east to west is going through. EU Stream weren't too happy about that, but agreed to it in the third quarter of 2020. But for the fourth quarter, when the repair had been completed, they said, no thanks, we want to go back to where we were previously, which is that if you want to reverse flow gas, you can physically do so through Budince. Now, there's nothing in the rules, in the European rules, that's stopping EU Stream from agreeing with Gas TSO of Ukraine to have the sort of virtual reverse flow that we have with Hungary and Poland. Let's see how that one goes. The other one that's interesting is the Southeast European line, the old Trans-Balkan line, through which there's now no gas flowing from east to west. That line crosses from Ukraine into Romania. It also goes through Moldova, rather complicated situation there. Basically, Moldova is now happy to have some virtual reverse flow there and has actually started using Ukrainian gas storage itself. Its requirement is quite small, but that's a logical thing to do. Situation with Romania and Ukraine will probably take longer to develop. I think there's also a question about the economic logic of bringing gas up that line from southeastern Europe, where prices tend to be a little bit higher. So there's an economic question mark as to the extent to which virtual reverse flow or reverse flow generally is ever going to make a lot of sense along that route.
Okay. Well, obviously, that's, as you say, been pretty much a success. I mean, the other success has been storage, which you've already mentioned. I mean, you could argue that Ukrainian storage actually bailed out the European market over the summer. But do you think that's a success that can be repeated? Is this an ongoing business opportunity for Ukraine now?
Yeah, I mean, I think just as, you know, our corner shop has sort of started selling masks or doing all sorts of things it never expected it would do in the pandemic, so Ukrtransgas, which operates the storage, has found this sudden and unexpected opportunity that Europe was absolutely overflowing with gas, storages were full, it had nowhere to go. The sort of prospect of a Texas situation of storage absolutely running out loomed large, and Ukrtransgas, with help from Gas TSO of Ukraine, stepped in and said, look, we've got all this storage here, and you know what, we'll do this customs warehouse arrangement, plus a good transit deal. They have this short-haul facility. So actually, if you move that gas in from Hungary and take it out into Poland or the other way around, you've got a discounted transport arrangement. So they've done all that. They've stepped in. Can it be replicated in the future? The confidence is there now. The business relationships are there now. Why not?
So we should almost think about Europe having an extra 8 to 10 BCM of storage available, essentially, in Ukraine.
Well, that's right. And I mean, that storage capacity in Ukraine is historically, it's there because that was the point at which the gas left Soviet territory. It's absolutely enormous. It's sitting there. Might as well use it.
Okay, good. Well, look, let's move on from that story to a sort of more domestic story. I mean, you've already talked about demand being down, imports now lower than domestic production. I mean, we've even heard claims that Ukraine might become self-sufficient in gas. From a production perspective, is that really feasible?
I think production is one of the really difficult areas for Ukraine. The economics of oil and gas production are the same as they are everywhere else, which is absolutely terrible. And the big companies that were looking very seriously at PSAs in Ukraine in 2012, 2013, then exited as a result of all the political turmoil in 2014. So Shell actually had a PSA, which they've now pulled out of. Chevron was close to doing one. ExxonMobil and others were looking at a big project in the Black Sea. That's all gone to zero because of the political conditions. And, of course, these companies operate on an international basis, and they've got lots of other places to go. So what we're left with is some Ukrainian domestic producers. The small private companies are increasing their production. They've got back to increasing it after some disruption over the last couple of years, but prices are what they are. Regulatory environment has improved, but the targets that we were talking about, which was that all of Ukraine's essentially 30 BCM of demand would be met from domestic production, I think won't be reached. Domestic production last year was somewhere between 20 and 21 BCM. And keeping it at that level has been an achievement because obviously Ukraine's lost the gas it was producing in Crimea. So I think it may creep up slowly during this decade, but not more than that.
Okay, so all right, that's a sort of stable situation, but not much growth. What about the? Let's go on to the domestic market. I mean, I guess with imports coming in, I mean, more important than ever that market reform moves on. How is market reform progressing?
It is progressing. There's two segments to the market. So if we take the numbers for last year, the unregulated sector of the market is 13 BCM. That's industrial consumers who've long been paying market prices. That's gas companies' own use, including quite a chunk of gas which is needed for the compressor stations on the transportation system. Then there's a regulated sector of the market, or at least it was regulated last year, which is just under 17 BCM last year, and that's direct use by households, about 10 BCM, and the rest goes into the heat sector. Now, the big news this year is that from the 1st of August, the household sector is deregulated, so there was a public service obligation on Naftogaz to supply households, basically whether or not they paid for the gas, and even if they paid, whether or not that money found its way from the various municipal service companies to Naftogaz. That PSO has been cancelled. Competition is starting. First, I think, involving Naftogaz itself, which has the kind of firepower and the infrastructure in Ukraine to offer gas to household customers, between them and RGC Group, which is strong in distribution. That's part of the business group headed by Dmitry Firtash, who's a long-standing and quite controversial character in the Ukrainian gas business. So those two companies will start to compete. There's those 6 million households. That story will continue. Then next year, May 2021, is the target which has been set by the government and regulators to remove the public service obligation for the heat sector. And there's quite a few BCM of gas going into that heat sector. I think you'll see some interesting changes there. One change to mention that's already happened is that there were a number of large combined heat and power plants which were on the books of the State Property Fund. Now, seven of these are now on the books of Naftogaz. I think in six cases it's a management contract, but they're quite large. They're serving big cities with a lot of people in them. And I think there's some potential there for vertical integration. They've got the gas, they take that through to their own combined heat and power plant, and now, unlike before, have a bit more involvement in collecting the money and making sure that payment is made. I think that's an interesting move that Naftogaz has made, and I think reforms in the heat sector, for people who are interested in drilling down into the detail, is something to watch over the next year or two.
Okay, I'd like to keep the conversation moving on as we sort of head through towards the end of the podcast. I mean, exchange trading is something that's kind of emerged as well. We've got the UEEX, which I think you described as kind of fairly increasingly liquid in your paper. Can you talk us a bit through that a bit, and you know, how perhaps prices correlate with Europe?
Yes. The prices correlate very well with Europe. The graph is pretty kind of, there's two lines that are pretty tight. We can't show that on a podcast, but it's in the paper. I think about something between a BCM and 1.5 will go through the exchange this year. So the volumes were insubstantial before, but they're kind of noticeable now. Gas TSO of Ukraine has asked the government to change the rules so that it, instead of buying its gas for the compressor stations through an auction, buys it on this exchange. Now, if and when that change is made, that's quite a volume of purchases which will go through the exchange. That will help. And the exchange is doing the sort of things that you would expect an exchange to do as it develops. Within day and next day trading has been introduced in September. They had an awful problem before with imbalances just because the regulation was getting set up and getting going. That also has been, the rules there have been changed with the regulator's help. So it's now very expensive to keep imbalances, and traders will presumably stop doing that. They're looking into options, futures, and so on and so on. So I think that will grow.
Okay, interesting. It was something to keep an eye on, certainly. Let's broaden things out a little bit, if we may, as we come to the end. You talk a bit about energy policy discussions in Ukraine. You talk about coal phase out, electricity market reform, general kind of potential for decarbonisation strategy. What effect's that going to have on the gas sector? Is that positive news for gas?
I think it could be. Ukraine is like Poland. Coal phase out is a really difficult thing to talk about. There are huge communities, particularly in the east of the country, where they've had the military conflict as well to deal with, which are reliant on coal. It's now been articulated in government documents that there has to be a coal phase out, and the documents have started talking about that for the first time. Of course, Europe is putting pressure through the energy community on this. There's a national emissions reduction program, which is the crucial document in respect of the speed of that coal phase out. Ukraine has agreed with European regulators already to postpone the deadlines by which it has to stop the emissions of various pollutants. So there are deadlines basically for the end of this decade, 2028, 2033. And no surprise, the government's already, ministers have already started suggesting that those deadlines should be pushed out further. But one way or another, we are talking about coal phase out as a thing. I suspect that people who are making money from coal-fired power generation also aren't going to rush that process. But it's a process. What will coal-fired generation be replaced by? As in other parts of the world, the discussion is, can we go straight to renewables, or will gas, particularly smaller stations with new CCGTs, can these replace coal? People in the gas business certainly think so. So that is one to watch over a period of time.
Okay, excellent. Thank you. And finally, obviously, this sort of general political environment around Ukraine is always an interesting topic. Currently, we've got this confrontation between the president and the Constitutional Court, which appears to be pretty serious, and perhaps the most serious thing since 2014. Is that going to affect market developments in the gas sector?
I think it might do, Jim. I think the first thing to say, this is about the world we're living in, the president, as it's just been reported in the news this week, the president has contracted coronavirus. He's well, he's quite young and fit compared to lots of presidents in the world. But nevertheless, that has happened and I think may interrupt this process. But I think also it seems a bit of an intractable one. Basically, the president came in on this anti-corruption platform. We've got the National Anti-Corruption Bureau. And to cut a long story short, the Constitutional Court has gutted this National Anti-Corruption Bureau. The IMF, the World Bank, and all the international donors are not best pleased about this. The president has said very, very publicly, I want to fix this. But it's not entirely clear, because the whole point of the Constitutional Court is that that's the judiciary and not the legislature. It's not entirely clear how he can do that constitutionally. So it's a bit of a riddle, that one. And when the president hopefully recovers, I expect he'll be turning his attention to it. But I must say that not to end on too much of a down note, it does sort of remind me about something that you, Jim, will remember, the battles between the Russian presidency and the parliament in the 1990s, which did go on for rather a long time. So I think that's something that's there. I think that despite all that, market regulation and that other stuff which people need in order to work in the gas business is all functioning. And but I think, yes, this stuff may continue to trundle along in the background.
But just to end on a more positive note, I mean, I guess, you know, that your paper is about the Ukrainian gas sector 2030. I guess by 2030, you see the potential for the Ukrainian gas sector that is much more fully integrated with the European gas market, which is a pretty positive place to be, given where we've been over the last decade.
Absolutely. I mean, that's the way we're going. We've got the storage. We've got the virtual reverse flow. We've got a lot of European traders who've set up in Ukraine and have subsidiaries there and are working quite comfortably on the exchange or off it. We've got a big traded market already. That's all happening. I suppose the question to ponder, and the fact we're pondering it is itself good, is whether we'll see Russian gas brought and just sold in Ukraine for people to trade from there onwards, rather than having to be reverse flowed in any form whatsoever. So yeah, things are moving on, and Ukraine looks more like a European market than it did 10 years ago. And in another few years, it'll look an awful lot more like that. And that's the direction we're moving in.
Okay, great. Well, thank you very much indeed, Simon. We've actually reached the end of our time now. That was fascinating. So thanks to you for a very, very interesting discussion, which I hope that you, the listeners, have also found informative and interesting. You can find Simon's comment on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org, where you can also find our full podcast series, as well as all our other output. If you'd like some further information about the Institute, then you can also find details on our website. And with that, it just remains me to wish everyone good health to you and your families, to thank you for listening, and goodbye.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as all our written research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our oil, gas, electricity, or China programmes, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.